psychologically profile the average witch. Having only Erzsébet and a cursory experience of Goody Fitch as a sample population is hardly sufficient. But the only other source is secondary. Erzsébet's memories of other witches. These memories may say more about Erzsébet herself or her circumstances than they do about her mother, her mentor, etc. But the general type we arrived at was this. A witch generally speaks her mind when she can get away with it, doesn't care much about what men think, and is determined to have agency over her fate, even in a time and place when such a thing was hard to come by, which, Erzsébet added, was most of human history. Based on Erzsébet herself and her claims of her mother's behavior, it is also possible witches enjoyed the influence they had over men by their attractiveness, but this does not seem to be tempered by any fondness for the men whose heads they enjoyed turning. Sitting in Frank's study, where I preferred we congregate when the ODEC or office equipment was not specifically required, the four of us, with Erzsébet watching, sat musing upon this collection of traits as the two household cats wound their way around Frank's legs. "This isn't flattering," said Tristan, "but this also fits the psychological profile of a lot of prostitutes." Erzsébet laughed. "No disrespect," Tristan said. "It is amusing that it has taken you so many hours to come to this conclusion." "You mean you already knew? You could have told us this and saved us a lot of time."
"Yes," said Erzsébet, pleased.
"Why didn't you?"
"You put me through my paces to see what I could do. I wanted to see what it was like to be in your position. I have enjoyed it."
A moment of Tristan silently grinding his teeth. "So you are confirming that we need to look for prostitutes?" "Not any prostitutes."
"But it makes sense, yes," she said.
"It is one way to have children without the bother of husbands."
"I don't buy that," said Melisande. "That's a totally romanticized image of sex workers. They're generally poor and disenfranchised, and a witch with any savvy at all would never choose such a life, for herself or her children. In the documents I translated, witches were considered powerful and valuable by whoever was in charge. Even if they were seen as dangerous, they were valued."
"That doesn't mean they were married," said Erzsébet. "We didn't need to be married to have power."
Mel looked doubtful. "So was that the norm for witches? Being what, a courtesan, or at least someone's kept woman?"
Erzsébet gave Mel a look.
"I am only one witch and have lived in only one society of witches, at one moment in history. You, with your translations, have a broader knowledge than I do. But such a thing was referred to casually by my mother's friends. If a witch wanted children, there were always the wealthy men around who can treat you well and support a bastard without wanting to have to publicly acknowledge it."
A heavy thought came over me. "Did you do that?" I asked. "I mean, did you have children?"
Erzsébet gave me a look that scorched my liver.
"Of course not," she said after a moment. "I could not bear the thought that I would live to watch them age and wither and die, and I would still be here and have to bury them."
There was a long and uncomfortable pause. Mel looked down, seemed almost to huddle over herself. Tristan coughed.
"So we need to look for courtesans, high-ranking mistresses, that sort of thing."
"I would say so," said Erzsébet loftily.
"Hang on," said Mel, looking up. "This detap was near the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign, right? I don't know how much autonomy attractive, powerful women would be allowed in courtly circles. I think Elizabeth was increasingly paranoid and jealous as she aged. So maybe common prostitutes, after all."
"No," said Elizabeth. We would not tolerate being common.
Maybe an uncommon prostitute, then, who had her own reasons for staying away from the court, Mel suggested.
There were a lot of brothels in Southwark, where the theaters were, I offered. I read that in the program notes for Henry IV when Boston Shakespeare did it.
What do you think? Tristan asked Elizabeth. Does Southwark sound right to you?
She sniffed. I have never heard of this place, but if it is full of troublesome women, then you might be in luck.
Diachronicle. Days 335 to 352. Continued. Early July, Year 1. In which Tristan learns a euphemism. This pen writes no faster. The eclipse is now just 23 days away, and I continue to entertain foolish, fond thoughts that somehow I may yet escape 1851 London. I am sure I have already complained in these leaves about the stench, but as summer ripens, so too do its smells. No pension plan is worth this shit, in quite the most literal sense. I must tell this story more quickly, and elide some details to get it all down. I pled travel fatigue, and Tristan honored his word to take the next detap. He required a specific place to land in London, September 1601, during the week before the investor, Sir Edward Greylock, agreed to put his money into the Boston Council for Boston. This was an event we were able to date with precision from legal records. Finding a suitable landing place in that detap was more of a project. During the course of our research, we obtained scans of city maps that had been drawn up circa 1600 and printed them out on huge sheets of paper that we taped up all over the walls. There, they accumulated sticky notes, pushpins, and written annotations. It was while studying one of those that Tristan let out an oath much more explicit than we usually heard from him and jammed his finger into a smudge on a map so hard that it must have hurt. The smudge, magnified and examined, turned out to be the words, Ye Tear Sheet Brewery. As mentioned previously, Tristan had a sentimental regard for Old Tear Sheet Best Bitter, the flagship product of Tear Sheet Beverage Group Limited, which claimed to be one of the oldest continuously operating breweries in London. He'd spent a semester abroad in the city, and thought himself sporty for having acquired a taste for something so obscure. Not quite a microbrew, but neither a household name anywhere. Bottled, it was available at a select few package stores in New England. On tap, it could be had in some pubs that catered to Anglophiles and expats. Improbable as it might sound, further research bore out that Tear Sheet Beverage Group Limited really was a survival into modern times of the enterprise labeled on that old map. To Tristan's delight, TBG Limited were proud enough of their heritage and savvy enough with their marketing that a section of their website was devoted to the history of their plant in London. In the early 17th century, the brewhouse proper had boasted an adjacent public house. It was at most 200 yards from the Globe Theatre. Though the site did not mention it, the area had famously teemed with brothels. I went back into the Widener library stacks, where I discovered, to no great surprise, that the adjacent pub was too large, with too many upstairs nooks, to have been merely a pub. Given the neighborhood, it probably wasn't merely an inn, either.
So there it is, said Tristan, pleased, when I showed him a map I'd scanned at Widener. That's my ground zero. What else do we know about it?
The very word tear sheet was a slang term for a prostitute, I said. He pulled a face.
I had no idea.
The place was famous for always having six comely maidens working there, I said with air quotes, serving the customers ale and aught.
What's aught?
Asked Tristan. Whatever you want it to be, I said. Their names are not recorded, but as of 1600, we know that one was Irish and two were Scottish. If we're looking for loose women who would never fit in at Elizabeth's court, those three fit the bill. Especially the Irish one. She had to travel by sea to get there, and the seas between Ireland and England were full of pirates. And she would have almost certainly been Catholic. So why would she go there,
unless she had a very good reason.
Tristan sat at his desk examining the papers. The Tearsheet website had airbrushed the map a bit. In reality, not only was the pub next door bigger than the brewery claimed, but it was connected by an underground tunnel and secret passages on every floor, directly to the brewery itself, thus allowing Johns, who needed to remain anonymous, a way to escape if the brothel were raided by the constables. Too bad none of that was on the website. I think their sales might have improved if they'd shared all the dirt. Over the next 2 weeks, Tristan was on a crash course in preparing to pass as a visitor to Elizabethan London. We knew he would never get the accent right, but as with myself in Boston 4 years later, this was not an urgent issue. London's population was exploding, and the city was babbling away in different accents and dialects from all over. A benefit to choosing this DTAP was that it corresponded with the height of William Shakespeare's career, and American theaters are simply obsessed with Shakespeare. Therefore, Boston, despite its small size, was crawling with fight choreographers who specialized in the swordplay and knife skills common in Shakespeare's time, or at least in his playhouse. Tristan learned drills he could do on his own, and then honed his skills for hours each day in the one still separate office space in the Dodo building. He also practiced bowing, cap-doffing, eating without a fork, and sundry other small niceties, while I drilled him on Elizabethan turns of phrase. Our costumer friend helped again with clothing, renting us a variety of different men's outfits so that Tristan could practice putting them on and off, as we had no way of knowing what clothes he might eventually find himself in. He would be enormous by the standards of the time. The chances of his actually blending in were slim to none. I enjoyed watching him at his drills, even more than I'd enjoyed watching the ferryman row me across the Charles. I truly did not want to enjoy watching him. It seemed incestuous. I thought Tristan was a looker from the moment I'd laid eyes on him, but all of that had been swept to the back of my mind immediately because of the peculiarity of our meeting and then our unceasing work. Except for the small talk of our first meal together, we had barely ever chatted. Tristan, as a general rule, does not chat. I knew him so well and trusted him quite literally with my life. And yet, I hardly knew him at all. When he had been the brains of the operation, the guiding hand, the commanding officer, I somehow hadn't noticed that. But now as he was in training, I became the guide, and the dynamic shifted. I became his equal, in some ways his superior, and this, in turn, made me proprietary. I felt secret jealousy toward the rest of his life. How absurd, as he had no rest of his life. And in fairness, neither did I anymore. He seemed to have no friends locally, never mentioned his family, and I can't remember him referring to any memories or relationships. He was an unformed block, from which he was now laboring, literally, to sculpt a Renaissance man. Reader, that was an attractive thing to watch. It felt like failure and betrayal to admit this to myself. But the truth is, I had a fucking crush on... I somewhat fancied him. Always had. How ridiculous. Anyone could fancy Tristan Lyons. It took no special qualities. I wished to demonstrate, at least to myself, that I was made of special qualities. So I chose to disregard my sentimentality. This was hard because, first, he looked pretty hot when he was thrusting that rapier. And second, I was aware he was about to go away to a place far more dangerous than my DTAP had been, and while it was possible he would return immediately, it was also possible he would not return at all. That he would be really, truly, not just Schrodinger's cat-like, dead. Nothing like the possibility of eternal separation to bring out the romantic in a girl. But I squelched it. Before he went into the Odeck on July 19th with Erzsébet, I just clapped him on his shoulder. Said shoulder was clad only in a t-shirt. Recent improvements to the Odeck had included a heating system that made it into a shirt-sleeves environment, and we had taken our rack of snowsuits to Goodwill. I squeezed said shoulder, but did not speak any of the words that my mouth suddenly wanted to form. I gave him a peck on the cheek, and watched as he passed through the airlock into the decontamination chamber.
He'd already taken the medicines to sterilize his gut, but now scrubbed himself in the disinfectant shower and emerged in a pair of surgical scrubs, the ungainliness of which helped to dampen my romantic stirrings. Through the glass, I waved like a younger sister as her brother goes off to summer camp. He nodded while backing into the O-deck, where Ersebet was waiting. He closed the door behind him. Oda-sensei, at the control console, flipped up the cover over the toggle switch, switched it on. The klaxon clacked, however muffled. We waited. It felt like years passed. Finally, Ersebet opened the O-deck door. Oda-sensei powered down the O-deck. I had been hovering anxiously at the door. When he signaled me it was safe, I went inside. Lying on the floor were Tristan's scrubs and two white ceramic fillings I hadn't known about. How ridiculous to confess this, but it saddened me that I had not known about his fillings. The gulf of my ignorance regarding his dental work left me feeling irrationally bereft. Ersebet grabbed my arm and tugged it to get my attention. I forced my eyes away from the artifacts of Tristan to look at her. She reached gently for my face, and with her thumb and finger, caressed the very pursed space between my brows. I hadn't realized I'd been frowning. "If he doesn't make it back, you will easily find a better lover," she said consolingly. I blushed so intensely, it almost made my eyes water. "He's not my lover," I said irritably. Ersebet gave me a knowing grin.
"He's not your lover yet," she said.
Letter from Grania to Grace O'Malley. A Monday of Mid-Harvest, 1601.
Auspiciousness and prosperity to you, milady. Grania it is who's writing this, and 'tis the most astounding news I have to share with your grace. I'm after meeting a gentleman by the name of Tristan Lyons. You'll want to add him to your stable of faithful vassals, and I think he can find his way there with the proper inducements. I'll be working on him to that end, anyhow. I was putting in my time at the bawdy house beside the brewery. I know your grace would rather I not, but truly it's the best way to hide in plain sight, and sometimes it's great crack. I was servicing, or, to put it another way, being serviced by, a gentleman of Bess's court, a lumbering heap of a knight, and not the brightest candle in the chandelier. He thinks he's never revealing any secrets, but sure it's as easy to read him as it is to read the signs on the high street, so it's a mutually beneficial arrangement. Himself it was who let slip the rumour about the Earl of Essex some months back. As you might recall, this allowed your Grace's agent to adopt some of his lordship's silver that was left tragically unattended during his lordship's arrest. So there we were getting along with business. And I look over his shoulder, and what I see there in the corner is a bit of glamour. So I know there's some magic afoot, but it's not me performing it, and there's nobody else in the room. And just as it's occurring to me that another witch must be sending me something, what is there in the corner suddenly but a large handsome man, buck-naked, looking dazed as a newborn, and doesn't he fall right to his knees and clutch at his head in utter confusion? And then he moans a bit, louder than my dim fella, and my dim fella hears him, stops abruptly in his exertions, and looks over his shoulder. You don't want to have to go explaining to a man in the heat of passion why there's suddenly another naked man in the room, especially one who's a better specimen. This new naked fella, he was tall and broad, and the healthiest looking lad I've seen in ages, even finer than the lads back home. I guessed right off he was probably from the continent, or maybe the Golden Age. You know how them idiot pagans like to mess around. Not from around here, anyway, which means he would be needing clothing and some dosh, like they do. So I thought fast, and said to your man who was on top of me, "Hey, now, look, I've got you the voyeur you were importuning me for last week, but it's going to cost you extra for the privilege, so let's finish up here and give me the silver for it." He was too astonished to speak, and that gave me a moment to consider the situation. I had to reckon what the new fellow would be doing here, given he clearly was not Irish. He looked more Saxon, but what did that mean now the Vikings are no more? Was he an enemy or a friend? Did he come here deliberately to me, or maybe a blunder it was? He looked familiar, yet I knew of a certainty I'd never clapped eyes on him before, and as I needn't belabor to you of all people, milady, this told me that what was occurring here and now was sure to be repeating itself on other strands. Something was afoot. Some shite for brains was actually trying to accomplish something by sending this poor young buck to other times and places. He was still looking bollocksed, so I couldn't ask him yet. Meanwhile, my dim fella had collected his meagre wits enough to protest that he'd never wanted a voyeur. I said, "Oh, come now. I know you too well for you to hide anything from me. You're falling all over yourself for the opportunity. Finish off and be giving me the money, so." He's out of the humour now, which I don't mind. Very grudgingly, in a foul mood, he reaches for his belt on the floor and yanks out some extra coin and tosses them to me in a huff. The fellow on the floor has pulled himself together a bit, looks around the wee room, and his eyes widen. "It's all right, lad," says I to him. "You've played your part well so far."
"You'd be Grania," he asks, pronouncing it almost right, like he's been practicing.
Which was awkward, since I'm never going by that name at the tear sheet. "No," says I, giving him a wink to put him at his ease, and making a glance at the other fella. Which is where it all went sideways. This new fella is one of those literal-minded sorts so tediously common in this nation, who actually believes what he hears. He's not looking at me, supposing it were indelicate to gaze upon a naked lady, so he doesn't collect the wink.
"I beg your pardon," he says, ever so polite, and clambers to his feet, moving well, with an eye on the door.
Increasingly displeased is my dim fella about this turn of events, the more he thinks about it. He has no scruples about looking at a naked lady he's bought and paid for, so he takes in the wink and the glance, and even more displeased they make him. He pushes off of me, and turns around just in time to see the new fella thoughtlessly getting between him and his baldric, which he's slung over the peg beside the doorway. Suspended in that, of course, are the scabbards containing his rapier and his dagger. The new fella's still looking about himself in that way people do after they've been sent somewhere for the first time. It's all new to him. He doesn't appreciate that it's bad practice to come between a knight and his arms, doubly so when the knight's buck naked and just had a perfectly good fuck interrupted by a nasty surprise. My customer moves, fast, dropping one shoulder and barreling into the new man from behind, catching him in the ribs and giving him a good bash. It wouldn't have been an equal contest had the new lad been looking him in the face and on his toes. But as it was, the blow staggered him out of the way. While he was pivoting about and getting his balance, my customer made straight for the door and pulled his dagger out of its sheath, the chamber being far too small, you'll understand, for the rapier to be of any use. Well, to that point in the proceedings, the new arrival might have been in a bit of a daze, but the sight of bare steel in another fella's hand snapped him out of it in a trice, and suddenly, wasn't he moving with marvellous speed and sureness, as if he engaged in naked dagger fighting several times a day? Rather than stepping back, as an ordinary person might have, he moved toward the knight and got in close, stifling his movement even as he was drawing back to stab. Then something happened too quickly for me to follow it, and next thing I know, the dagger's clattering on the floorboards, and the Saxon has the knight's arm all twisted about in some manner of wrestling hold, I reckon. The knight tries to squirm out, but the visitor pushes a bit harder, and I can hear something threatening to give way in the shoulder joint.
"I yield," says he,
who's clearly got the worst of it. The new lad lets him go, but not before kicking the dagger across the floor, out of reach. I snatched it up so there'd be no more such foolishness, and clasped it to my breast.
Rarely have I enjoyed such spectation at the tear-sheet. The new lad was so fine to look at, and the other fellow was so dull, and I haven't got out to a bear-baiting or even a play in the longest time. To watch naked men have a go at each other with weapons is better than either. Makes me homesick, so it does. I humbly apologize for this misunderstanding, says the Saxon. I couldn't recognize the accent. His teeth were gorgeous. And for my unmannerly arrival. He said unmannerly as if it weren't a word used to coming out of his mouth. So I figured he were from a place where manners aren't important, but he's trying to respect the occasion, and I liked that well enough. Enough to want to keep seeing him naked, anyhow. So I take the dim fella's purse, help myself to my newly augmented fee, toss him his clothes, and give him a wink. Be changing outside now, I say, and send him off. That makes it easier to stare at your naked Saxon.
Grania, he said, but you don't go by that name. I understand.
You're not one of them locals, I observe.
What gave it away?
He asked. I like a bit of dry humor. I laughed. So tell me then, who are you and what is it brings you here? Who sent you?
Classified, he said.
Never heard of him. Perhaps a Cornish name, is it? Protestant or Catholic?
"'Tisn't a name," he said. "It means I cannot tell you. I am under orders not to tell you."
"Are you? How's your master expect you to get anything done, then? Once you've answered my questions to my satisfaction, I'll give you this extra money the fella left and get you some clothes, both of which you'll be needing. We've some extra shirts and drawers around for our favorite customers, since things do tend to get nicked here. But you'll get no help from me until you answer my questions. Right idiot your master is, if he thinks it works any other way. Clearly, the fellow's never been sent before. He got a caged bear look on his face, and I felt for him, but obviously it's not safe to do anything until I know more. I'm passing as Protestant Irish. It's my excuse for being in London instead of back home. But Protestant Irish is a hard act to play without giving it the full Puritan extreme, and that's not safe either. I have to watch my back all the time. I needed to know where his sympathies were. And then he uttered such an idiot claim.
I'm here for a purely economic concern, he says. It's just financial. I've got no political or religious affiliation.
Is it Protestant money or Catholic money you're after? I ask.
It does not matter, he says. Not where I come from.
Where in God's name do you come from? I ask again. May I go there with you? Because in the name of our Lord's mammy, if I could be someplace where money's got no religion and religion's got no money, I'd be a happier woman. He sits on the bed beside me, turned a little away so I can't see his front so well. I did try to peek, though. He said he would tell me as much as he could, anything that wasn't
classified.
And here's what he told me. I'll make it as brief as I can, but it was quite the long chat we had about it. He is from the future, from a land that will become an English-speaking nation some day, but not a part of England. So their accursed language triumphs, but they themselves do not. The fuckers lose most of Ireland as well, turns out. I don't know how long it will take this to happen. Maybe 10 years, maybe 100. I pressed him for details, especially about your Grace's legacy, of course. But he said he couldn't give me any unless I let him get dressed, which I wouldn't. It was great crack to see how uncomfortable he was being naked. Guess you don't do that much in the future, I teased him. Thought that would be a constant across the ages, how bawdy houses work.
I have never been to a bawdy house before, he said.
Of course I didn't believe him, but it wasn't important, so I pressed on, trying to learn more about this future where the best-looking fellas speak English but are not, in fact, English. We spent no small sum of time discussing why wearing clothes would make it easier for him to speak. Otherwise, all I could get out of him was that the land that the English are now preparing to settle in the New World breaks away from England to become its own nation, and keeps speaking English, but becomes notable for its deep regard of Ireland. This is especially true of the area where he himself had come from directly, which is a province with the queer enough name of Massive Shoe Hits. Cod, I expect. Anyhow, seems in the future there will be lots of Irish running around over there, but they'll be speaking English. So where's their loyalty? I demanded, and he said it's with themselves. They get distracted with their new world. They don't have the energy to stay preoccupied with old grudges. Eventually, I mean, it takes a while. Beyond that, the most I could get out of him was that he had come back in time to me, specifically, to seek my assistance. Wasn't I flattered at that, I confess. How did you know to find me? I asked. Classified, he said quickly, and then grimaced and corrected himself. I can't tell you, but I know you're the right one for me to ask for help. All right then, what be in it for me? I asked, given you've no money to offer me, and refusing you are to tell me about the future, which is the only reason I'd be interested in you. Except maybe for playing around, because you are a beautiful specimen of a man. I'll wager all your children are beauties. Might we continue this conversation once I'm clothed? Himself asks again, with a bit more urgency now, as my words are having their effect and he's beginning to get big and firm down below. Lordy no, I say. I am enjoying this too much. Do you know how rare it is to sit next to a fellow who's clean and nice-looking and isn't asking anything of me? It's enough to make me want to offer myself. That's not why I'm here, he says, crossing his legs more than a bit awkwardly. Well then, tell me why you are here, I ordered. I need to convince a man named Sir Edward Greylock that he should invest his money in the East India Company. Sure, I've heard of Sir Edward. We've some friends in common, if you take my meaning. Oh, do you know how to find him? I might, I say, and it's pretty confident I am about it. Your Grace might remember the wee peccadillo of last year with that German banker fellow and the silk merchant. Sir Edward is the German's grand-nephew on his ma's side, and I met him in passing at the funeral, but he was quite drunk, so he wouldn't remember me. However, knowing the family to be Protestant bankers, I've kept a careful eye on all their spawn. And, as your Grace knows well, I've made it my business to win the confidences of some of the wenches working the taverns near Whitehall Palace, and I keep an inventory in my head of their regulars' habits, same as they themselves do. So I happen to know that Sir Edward Greylock is a regular for late dinner at the Bell on King Street, right by the stairs. I didn't tell my Saxon all this, of course. First I had to know more from him. Is it that you want to ruin Sir Edward, and that the East India Company is going to fail? I asked. Or is it that you want him to succeed, and it's going to thrive? Answer if you want my help. Neither, really. I just want to distract him from putting his money into another company. I'm trying to avoid something. So it's another enterprise that you want to see fail, I said. He nodded once. Is it Protestant or Catholic? This other one. That's truly got nothing to do with anything, he insisted. If you know what comes of the East India Company, tell me, since that will be useful to somebody I know, and you'd better make yourself useful if you expect me to give a shite about you. I can't tell you what happens with the East India Company. Classified, is it? Yes, classified. Good-o. Godgy good day, then, I said cheerily, stood up from the mattress and headed for the little curtained doorway. Where are you going? He demands, paling a little. I'm leaving you with your classifieds, I said. I'll keep my own classifieds until you're willing to have a fair exchange. And I left the room, went down the wee corridor and climbed down the steps to the ground level where the tavern is. I went out back, used the privy, then stepped back into the tavern to see if anyone was in need of me. But it was that time of day when the few men there are mostly there for the drink. So having left the Saxon alone for about as long as it would take to walk a half mile, I returned to the wee chamber, and as I anticipated, he was more willing to negotiate. He allowed that the East India Company is a good investment for those who can risk it. It takes a while to come to much, but then it will be around a long while, and 'tis a private company with good returns on the investment in time. So, Your Grace, let me know if you're interested in channeling some funds that way, and I'll alert your agent here. If it's good enough for a fugger, it's good enough for a fucker. Meanwhile, since I wanted him to see he'd get rewarded, and since sadly it seemed we weren't going to have any kind of adventure while he was naked, I pulled out the extra set of drawers and shirt that were hiding under that very mattress the whole time, and tossed them to him. I'll help you find your Sir Edward, I said, but first we need to kit you out in more than underwear. Lucky for you, it's me you sought out, as I'm the one best knows how to get togamans for such a large lad. Once he had donned the threads I had for him, he relaxed a bit, and even introduced himself properly. Tristan Lyons, he claims to be. Can't make out where he's really from by the name, any more than by the looks. French, maybe? In which case, likely Catholic, but not likely an ally even so. The French are slippery that way. I decided to take him to the Globe, on account of Dick Burbage has a closet full of costumes he did steal from Ned Alane. He played a heap of roles in his day, did Ned, so I was hoping we could make Tristan over into whatever would be most expedient for his undertaking. 'Tis a short walk from the Tearsheet to the Globe, mostly along the river, and one I never thought of as remarkable. But you'd think I was asking Tristan to eat a sewer. Practically retching the whole way he was, despite my taking him along the broader lane where gravel is laid down over the clay, and all the sewage lies neatly in the drainage ditches to the side of the streets, not like some alley where the offal sits right in the street once it's dumped from above. 'Twas only a turd or two we had to sidestep, not counting the horse manure, which isn't at all offensive. In fact, it has a barnyard smell that reminds me of home. Tristan Lyons had only his underclothes on, of course, but in this part of town that hardly draws attention, no matter he was such a large fella. Crowds were streaming into the Globe's gates. Trumpets did sound from within, and then I recognized Hal Condell's voice like an oratorio, which meant they were beginning some fool play. Tristan's attention turned toward the gate as if he were curious to go in. 'Tisn't that way we're going, I said. That phrase, he said, looking surprised. Even I know that phrase. Star-crossed lovers. They're doing Romeo and Juliet in there, the original Romeo and Juliet. No, the original had Saunder Cook as Juliet, I said. That was much better than whoever's doing it since Saunder grew a beard. Anyhow, it's a shite play. Just a stupid court-sponsored rant against the Irish. I grabbed his arm and began to pull him through the floods of people streaming back into the theatre. We must need get around to the back of the stage where the tiring house was. How is it anti-Irish? Tristan asked. The villain is a Catholic friar, I pointed out. He being a meddling busybody who traffics in poison, he's the reason it's a tragedy and not a comedy. And everyone knows Catholic is code for Irish. Aren't the French Catholic? Asked Tristan. And the Spanish? The friar's name is Lawrence, I countered as I pulled him along. So obviously named after St. Lauros. He was martyred by drinking a poison of his own concocting. The whole play is just a coded insult to the Irish, a demonstration of how amoral we supposedly are. It's bollocks. You be missing nothing, especially now that Saunders grown a beard.
I don't want to see it. I just never heard that Shakespeare hated the Irish before,
said Tristan, only it was so crowded there that he was shouting just to be heard as all the people pressed past us to get inside. Why would anyone in your time give a shite about Will Shakespeare's politics? But he is, I said. I can quote reams of examples, same as anyone. Worst of all was just the other year. One of them plays about some English king, and there was a terrible drunk Irish character staggering about the stage, wailing about how all the Irish are villains and bastards and knaves. And a while before that, he had a play about some other English king who went to conquer Ireland, and he said the Irish live like venom. Venom! That's poison, so it is. He's obsessed with the Irish and poison, trying to convince the masses that one of us is planning to poison the Queen.
Are you? Asked Tristan.
Course not. Not worth the risk. She'll be dying soon anyhow, and 'tisn't as if she could suddenly produce an heir at her age. There'll be chaos soon without us meddling.
Fair enough, he said.
It is not fair enough. It would be fair if she'd died years ago. 'Tis always the wrong ones living too long, and the wrong ones dying too young. And then, because this touches a subject near to my sensitive heart, of course I pressed on. Like my Kit Marlowe.
Who's Kit Marlowe?
I stopped walking and let the crowd bump past me as I turned to him. Christopher Marlowe? Are you telling me you've never heard of Christopher Marlowe?
Christopher Marlowe? Of course I know the name.
He thought a moment.
He was a spy and a writer, but I was not briefed about him in depth because he died years before I needed to arrive here.
Briefed? There's nothing brief about him, except his life. He is only the greatest playwright that ever was, who only wrote the greatest play that ever was. And because no light of recognition went on in his pretty eyes, I prompted, "It's Tamburlaine, I mean." He shrugged.
"I do not know it."
I was incredulous, and I expressed my incredulity with colourful language.
"More famous than Hamlet?"
he asked. I figured he was codding me and almost fell over with the laughter. "Are you taking the piss, Tristan Lyons?" I asked. "Hamlet's a dull fuck of a story where a fellow stands around lamenting how useless he is, even to his own self, and then there's one pansy sword fight and it's over. The only good part of that is what he nicked from Kit's Dido." Tristan shrugged again.
"I'm not much of a theatre-goer."
"No theatre, no whoring. Pray, what is it you do for recreation, then?" But before he could answer, we'd reached the back of the globe, and they know me in the tiring house, so I grabbed him by the hand and in we marched. The tiring house is a fair way to madness, and it was a big masquerade ball scene they were gearing up for, with all the supernumeraries donning gorgeous gowns and robes and masks the like of which could have afforded us half your grace's navy for a season. The prop man, I never have learned that fella's name, and his lads were flying around, handing out masks and candles and chalices and baited rapiers and kerchiefs, and I could hear the musicians in the gallery above tuning quietly, while Dick Burbage was bellowing on the boards, pretending to be a horny young man, which he is, except for the young part. "Here to see Dickie," I say to the prop man. He looks disgruntled, which is his usual state, and he says, "Come back after the show is down." Then he sees Tristan, and his eyes fix on him, because Tristan is big, and I realize prop man is worried about costuming him. He's there in nothing but undergarments, so he looks as if he must be expecting a costume, which is true, in a way. "He's with me," I say, "only I need to speak to Dickie about some clothes for him." Prop man frowns, cocks his ear towards the upstage center curtain.
"He's almost off," he whispers. "And he's not in scene three."
Tristan and I try to stay out of the way of all the foot traffic by pushing ourselves against the wall. It smells foul in there. There's some silks being worn by boy actors that stink like they came right from a brothel, and I don't mean that in a nice way. But we're only there a few moments when in through the curtain, right from the stage, comes Dick, trussed up like a boy, although it's a bit long in the tooth he is now for the likes of Romeo. He sees me through the crowd of milling minions, and the smile he gives me could light the heavens. He's that fond of me, and sure, why wouldn't he be? "Gracie!" he calls out to me, for that's how they say my name here, and yours as well, Your Majesty. In England they do say Grace O'Malley. The prop man hushes Dick with irritation, but like always, Dick ignores the prop man. "What do you mean, finding a bigger man than I?" Burbage says. He pushes his way through the crew of underlings, all of whom disregard him, as if he were one of them, and not the richest and most renowned actor in all creation. He comes to us, looking Tristan Lyons up and down. Tristan Lyons says nothing, just gazes levelly back at him.
"You a comedian, fellow?"
he asks Tristan and claps him hard on the shoulder. Then he looks surprised, as if he had just struck a boulder while thinking he'd be striking wool.
"No," says Tristan, "soldier."
And Dick, he backs up a bit, looks respectful.
"Who do you fight for, then, lad?"
he asks. "Classified," I say. Dick looks impressed.
"If you be Gracie's friend, then you're a friend of mine," he says, without introducing himself, assuming he would not need to, assuming everyone knows him already, sure. "And I'll help you out however you need it."
It's costumery he's needing, I say. Nothing outlandish, mind you. Needs to blend in with some fellas down by Whitehall. "I was thinking you had Ned Alleyne's..."
"I do indeed," says Dick.
And to Tristan,
"Honoured to be of service to you, sir. I'm back on in a moment, so we must be quick, but follow me."
He gestures us to follow him through the whispering mob to a tiny closet along the inner wall. He, being a principal shareholder, he has the privilege of some small privacy. In this closet are some pegs, and on them hang clothes, custom-made for a man of easily Tristan Lyons' height. These were some of the costumes of Edward Alleyne, tallest actor of our age, and the leading man of the rival company, the Admiral's Men. So tall he is, nobody can fit into his clothes, not even Burbage, who stole them as a prank when Ned retired a few years back. "Make him a gentleman, or a knight, or a wealthy merchant," I suggested, as Dick glanced between the pegs and Tristan.
"All right, I've an idea," he said.
He chucks aside some galligaskins and then a pair of French hosen filled with bombast, and Tristan's looking relieved he won't be wearing anything so ponce-like. Finally, Dick pulls out some longer Venetians that tie below the knee. They're made of damask, Pluderhosen style, a dark blue with red showing through at the slashes. He also pulls out some black silk nether stockings to go under them, and then a blue velvet vest. Also, a blue worsted doublet with a codpiece attached, but I protest that, on account of the heat of the day. "Haven't you a mere jerkin?" I ask, and sure enough he has, a red velvet one with gold and ivory buttons, and stiff shoulders sticking out like the stubs of angel wings.
"No codpiece with it, though," says Burbage. "Sorry, fellow."
Then a crowned felt hat, and a ruff for the neck, and cordwain boots, which are nicer than the workman's galoshes I'd found for him back at Tearsheet.
"You'll have to dress yourself. I'm back on stage in 15 lines, he says,
when he's hauled it out and then reclosed the closet. I thanked him and promised him to return the costumes quickly. He kissed my cheek, saluted Tristan, and dashed back out onto the stage, groaning like a man suffering unrequited love, followed by a handful of merry lads with masks and torches and one god-awful pipe player. Tristan had, throughout this, remained quiet and somewhat stiff, taking it all in. I wonder what his home time must be like in comparison. I help him to dress, the mad hushed bustle of getting ready for the ball scene all around us. He's a wee bit shorter and a wee bit broader than Ned Alane, but the clothes fit him well enough.
Who was that man?
He asked when we're safely outside the bounds of the globe. Among many other fellows, Hamlet, I say, and I roll my eyes, and Romeo. He doesn't look so very impressed, and my regard for him, it rises a bit. Plus, he's easy on the eyes, with the jerkin all laced up, and his muscles nearly bulging through it. Ned Alane didn't have those lovely teeth either. So I'm enjoying our little assignment. It's a grand way to pass the day. I say it's to Whitehall we're heading. He appears to know something of it. We walk out to the Thames, and himself sees that massive long London bridge to the east with all its fine buildings and some 24 traitors' heads decaying on the great stone gate, and his eyes pop right open like a caged monkey's. So I reckon he's from a place without much architecture to speak of. I can't wait for him to see Savoy Palace and all them. He might fall right into the Thames. I budge his elbow and point to the west. This way, I say. He follows, looking like I did the first time I ever stepped into St. Paul's. The tide's starting to turn, and the upstream boats are starting to struggle, so I decide we'll walk to the river bend and go across there. I find the walk refreshing, for there's open air over the Thames, which is nicer than the open sewers of Southwark. But the mild dyspeptic look he's had on his face hardly lessens as he walks along. He must be from some small village in the New World to have such a hard time with the city air. But then he gazes upon all the barges and ships and wherries with a keen look that makes me think he might have a nautical background. He's fascinated by all of them, the dung boats no less than the Queen's glass barge, and he asks questions that I answer best I can. I try to make some conversation about himself, but he's not at all forthcoming about himself or the reason for his mission. I don't push him for it now. That can come in time. Trustingly dependent I'll make him. Then, when he is particularly in need of my assistance, I'll demand cooperation. I've done it often enough. We walk by the Paris Gardens, and you can hear the bears and the dogs, and isn't the crowd loving it? It always gives me a laugh that the Queen will bring herself all the way over here to watch the bear baiting, but has never once stepped into the globe, for all Will Shakespeare's trying to kiss her arse with his Irish-hating sentiments. Less than halfway along our walk, where the narrow wall begins on our shore, all the palaces of bishops and nobility become visible on the far bank. Salisbury House, all the inns of court, Arundel House, and the rest. I point them out to him. Of course, I know them all from various dalliances I have contrived on your Grace's behalf. But he does not goggle at them as he had at London Bridge.
A little different from my own time, is all he says.
At this point, the Thames bends to Snake South, and soon as I hear a ferryman calling, "Westward ho!" I hail him. We're taking this wherry, I explained to Tristan, for a penny, which will come out of your money that I procured so cleverly for you from the dim fella. The ferryman fetches us across, brings us to the far side without the tide causing him too much grief. Tristan pays his penny, and then it's just a street away we are from King Street, in the shadow of Whitehall Palace, and right away is the Bell Tavern. One of three taverns where the minor courtiers like to eat and drink and sometimes do other things. I'm more at home in Southwark and less conspicuous, but as your Grace knows, it's plenty of time I spend here. It was quiet there for the time of day, as the last of the diners were finishing. A strange stillness after the din and bustle of the streets and the Thames. I nodded to Mary, who works there. She nodded back at me, and her eyes found Tristan, and they opened wider. Then she gave me an approving look. I sauntered over to her, and said low in her ear, "Sir Edward Greylock, you have said he was a dinner-time regular."
"Indeed he is, and you're in luck. He's just finishing his lamb."
With a jut of the chin, she gestured towards a fellow of perhaps 30 years, tall and elegant, but with a willowy, pale presentation, sitting alone at a table by the door, the dregs of another diner's meal across from him, as if a strong wind would bend him over. Curly reddish-brown hair and pink cheeks made him look almost feminine. A pretty man all around, but not impressive. I recognized him from a few times when I was spending the evening with one of his acquaintances. I, in turn, pointed him out to Tristan. It is now that Tristan begins to impress himself upon me in a good way. For what does he do but approach Sir Edward, and with the most nuanced mixture of respect and swagger, he does bend the knee just a wee bit and lowers his head, doffs his hat and holds it down by his right leg, kisses his left hand and says, "God give you good day, my lord." And then, as if turned to stone, he awaits to be noticed by Sir Edward. Sir Edward looks up from his lamb pie and stares at Tristan, perhaps as distracted by his manly physic as Mary was. "Well met, sir," he said, uncertain of Tristan's rank from his piecemeal attire. "I cry you mercy, my lord," says Tristan, not at all like a fellow who comes from a time and place without any English nobility oppressing him. "I'm a gentleman soldier from the Isle of Man, and I would beg a boon of you." And when Sir Edward did not appear ready to disregard him, he pressed on in a steady enough voice. "The world speaks of you as friends with the Earl of Cumberland, and he is a lord I fain would meet, but have no means of introduction."
"And who might you be, sir?"
asked Sir Edward. Without malice, he said it, studying him.
"I am called Tristan Lyons, and I am a Manx adventurer, recently returned from Java."
Confusion flashed across Sir Edward's face. "An adventurer?" he said, and then seemed to choose polite caution by gesturing warmly to the seat across from him. "Pray be seated," he said. "What would you with the Earl?"
"Faith, sir, in Java I befriended some agents of the Earl of Cumberland, and heard from them of some ambitious plans intended by the Earl and his aldermen and knights."
"Aye, the East India Company?" says Sir Edward.
"Just so, my lord. My connections are all abroad, and I fear I cannot write to them in time for them to send references of my character before the Earl sends Sir James Lancaster off on his next voyage. I would be deeply in your debt if you would consider brokering an introduction. I can hardly conceive of a better investment to be made with my inheritance."
At this, I nearly burst out laughing, for he sounded not at all excited, but as if he had been carved from a bit of peat and only half animated. But then, your grace, he continued to speak and to describe in such details the quality of the Javanese pepper harvest that in faith my own mouth was watering, and I have never even tried the stuff. And since I knew his motives, didn't I marvel at how well he kept his true intention from this fella? Spoke as if he hadn't one jot of interest in seeing the fella himself invest in the Earl of Cumberland's schemes. Sir Edward says he regrets to inform Tristan that Sir James set sail back in April, and Tristan begs his pardon and asks him does he think it might be possible to make an investment anyhow, toward future returns? Then Tristan goes on a bit, and begins to speak in tones of wonder and reverence, as if he were merely musing aloud to himself, of hither India. There is one thing in particular he goes on about, and that's spices called turmeric and saffron, the both of which create a cheery yellow-orange dye for silks and cottons, fabrics easy to obtain in hither India. And now it's Sir Edward I'm watching, as his face becomes a marvel of interest. Suddenly he says he's a mind to speak to the Earl himself, and see about such an investment, and if Tristan will come to see him in 2 days' time, he will happily inform him of the possibilities. Tristan falls all over himself with appreciation and gratitude, honours Sir Edward as if Sir Edward were a king and himself a peasant, and then with some assistance from me, whom Sir Edward never once regarded directly, removes himself from the building, but not before making certain that Sir Edward knew he could find some pleasant behind-the-door diversions at the Tearsheet Brewery in Southwark, for which I am much obliged. That was nicely done, I said, as we walked back toward the river bank,